A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling chatty. Like a chatty, funny man. And that's very handy, isn't it? Because today's guest is here to do something very special, which is turn the tables on Talk Art and will become the interviewer instead of the interviewee. And today is a special day because it is the day our second book, Talk Art, The Interviews, which is also very chatty because you and I have been chatting for about hundreds of hours, literally hundreds of hours, over the past few years since 2018. And our new book, Talk Art, The Interviews, is actually very different to the first one. It includes 24 interviews and it is out now. You can get it from Waterstones and all bookshops around the world. So we are here to talk about ourselves. So we may as well get straight to today's guest, but I just want to quickly say something about him. He is a shining light. He's someone that has made all of our lives so much better over the past few decades. I loved him when he first appeared on our screens, on like all those sort of chat shows on Channel 4 or ITV or all the different ones. And also he's a friend of Adele. So any friend of Adele is a friend of ours. And I just love him. And I've met him once before.
Oh, but get I know on you, with it. Get
I know
on
that
with
Russell,
it. Just say my
Russell's
name. Come
a very,
on, please.
A very good friend of yours, Russ. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art the global icon that is Alan Carr.
Listen, I didn't recognise myself there with that intro. I was looking behind me going, who the hell? Global icon? Well, I suppose.
You're in our hearts, Alan.
Oh, you are so sweet. Listen, you are right. I am a phenomenon, but also your podcast is a phenomenon, isn't it? I've seen the 5 million downloads, 200
Six
episodes.
Now.
Six million downloads. Yeah. Wow. 200. You need to sort that out in your book because I got that fact in your book. You need to get the Tippex out.
No, it's literally this week, though. Like the week the book comes out, we hit 6,000. Sorry, 6 million.
6 million.
I'm so tired.
It's gone down.
6 million.
It's gone down since I've started interviewing you. Alan Carr, the brand, is so toxic that I can see your book being pulped by the end of this. No, don't be
Britney Spears wrote a song about you.
Now, listen, and now this goes out in 170 countries. And reading the intro to the book as well, isn't it wonderful that actually artists listen to your podcast? Isn't that nice that they listen to it as well? You must be so chuffed with that.
Yeah, really handy.
Yeah, but
it's incredible. It is incredibly humbling to know that, you know, we are art geeks and we've created this thing because we love art. And artists have told us time and time again that they're in their studios and they put Talk Art on and they just have it in the background while they're working. And not only that, we are connecting to people outside of the art world and they're having the same experience and they're going about their days. And it's just the phenomenon of art and how art does actually connect everybody is such an amazing thing.
I think also in the pandemic, the podcast really blew up and also our first book got really popular because it came out when all the bookshops were closed and we were like, oh my God, it's going to be, you know, it won't sell or whatever. But instead it did the opposite because actually everybody wanted the book in their homes with these beautiful pictures, with the stories of artists. And I think it does kind of bring hope and inspiration to so many people. And there's also loads of like fashion designers and like filmmakers and like architects who listen to it in the office or like, you know, in their studios, in their where they're making all their fancy clothes and stuff. It's wild, like to think the kind of different places people hear it.
And you actually say in the book that COVID, in a way, we were all bored at home. You got access to some amazing guests, including Elton John. I mean, how amazing is that? And what the joy of the podcast is, and especially the book, you find out different things about. I didn't know Pierce Brosnan was a painter. I didn't know Paul Smith went to the Slade Art School. And I didn't know Elton collected so much photography. I mean, tell us about that. I mean, when did you hear that Elton wanted to chat to you?
Well, I'd been trying to pin him down, and he'd always been super busy, obviously doing tours and everything. I think
being
the one
Elton
that he's
John.
Just being Elton John around the world.
That's and he a was full-time on the
job. Like, it is a full-time job, and he was like, "Darling, soon, darling, soon, darling." And then when we went into lockdown, prior to that, me and Rob had only ever interviewed people in person. We went to a studio, or we went to their houses with equipment, and we'd never worked out how to do it remotely. But suddenly, in the lockdown, we were given the gift of being locked in and working out remotely, and suddenly everybody was available. So I said to Elton, hey, you are locked down, obviously. You're not doing anything, I don't think, as is the rest of the world. How about you come on the podcast now? And he was like, yeah, why not? So we suddenly had this real opportunity to connect to everybody, and we knew exactly what they were doing. They were doing nothing like the rest of the planet. And it was a fertile ground to kind of connect to people in.
Yeah, the other special thing about Elton is he made that decision himself. I love the fact that I think a lot of his kind of success comes from the fact that he listens to so much new music, but bands none of us have ever even heard of yet. He like hears their demos, you know, from their managers before they're even released, and contacts those people and supports them. But it's not just music artists. He also supports contemporary artists. And like there's loads of photographers that we know and painters who have met Elton like really young in their careers. And he's the one driving all of that, and it was him who wanted to come on the podcast. And like I always assumed that big stars like that have these kind of press agents and people that strategically tell them, you know, exactly every move they should be making. But I think the greats actually dictate that for themselves.
He's so giving, Elton, isn't he? I mean, he's like, you know, he has this reputation for being a diva, but every time I've met him, he's been so gracious and so supportive of new people coming through. I remember one of my first gigs I did for an AIDS charity at Royal Albert Hall, and I did my stuff and he was headlining at the end, and he played, you know, amazing on the piano. Then he called us all out. And then people don't know this, but my dad's a football manager and actually sold Elton John a player from when he was at Watford, the chairman. So Elton calls me over as he's playing piano. Alan, how's your dad? And I was like, oh, yes, he's good like this. I'm like, Elton John talking to me? I should be tasered. Why are you talking to me? And he was, and of course, everyone in the audience is thinking, oh, I bet they're talking about cock or bumming or something. But we were talking about Watford and football and players' career. But I've always found him so lovely and warm. And
yeah, same.
And it's great. And it comes across in the interview as well. He's clearly passionate. And that's one thing. You've got so many amazing names on here. Tracy Emin, Dame Rachel White, Grayson Perry, Stephen Fry. Did you find they all had one thing in common? Did you find they had a certain quirk? Because when I'm reading the interviews, I get this sense of collecting, archiving, keeping. Did you find that? Did they all have one little quirk that drove them all together?
God, that's really interesting. Well, I mean, the quirk is art, isn't it? Fundamentally, that brings everyone together. But what if they have any sort of like eccentricities or something that everybody shares?
I think they're all incredibly focused.
But I mean, I'm fascinated by the collector thing. They all seem to want to archive, you know, keep
protect
stuff.
Things,
yes.
Have things around you. And I mean, that's what me and Rob have. So I guess we do connect to them people more because we have that same drive to, you know, bring stuff into our lives and have stuff around us that makes us feel good. But yeah, it is a weird, for collecting is such a weird phenomenon that they've done, like, you know, they look back at your childhood. And at one point we had a guest on that said that they thought if you got out of your nappy too soon or you had your nappy on for too long, it suddenly made you a collector. It was quite a weird, like, Freudian thing that apparently if you had a nappy on for too long that you would start buying art. But it was, I don't know what the connective thing is really, but it is definitely a certain nuance that art has.
I think it's also like a search for meaning, and some they're all very purposeful people. And you've got people like Paul Smith. We actually went to his headquarters in Covent Garden in London, or near Covent Garden, and every wall, every single inch of the walls from the floor to the ceiling was covered in art. And it wasn't really about fashion. His whole building was about art. You know, it's like this huge collection of drawings, paintings, photographs. They all have these personal stories. And there's pictures in the book actually of when we went to meet him. And I think there's definitely something of like this cocooning around you of like of creativity and that kind of bubble. And I feel like that in his studio provokes him to then think differently, to think, you know, how can I make this shirt? How can I make this suit? What color will I make it? You know, because color is such a big thing for him. And I saw him say a quote last week that said something like, if you're successful in your job, you always need to have a few outside kind of like hobbies, essentially, but things that you really passionately are obsessed with. And he's obsessed with like cycling and photographing and interviewing, he said, like those three things. And that those things then inform what he does. And I think if you think of someone like Tracy does collect, but not art as much. I mean, she has some other artists, as she calls them, other artists in her archive. She has loads of other artists. But I think for her, she has this kind of way that she cannot stop making. You know, even when she was really ill after her cancer, like she spent a few years here in Margate afterwards, and she was always drawing in books anywhere she could. And there's some kind of need to express herself. And in the same way, she ends up filling spaces, you know, like her studios are just filled with paintings. And she also surrounds herself with her own art. So there is some kind of connection psychologically. And it definitely has to do with this kind of like, Russell, is that your dogs?
Yeah, I was going to close this door. 2 seconds.
Someone fallen down the stairs, Russell.
I know, it did sound like that. It was like, what the hell is that? Was
someone like in a shell suit slowly falling down some stairs.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, and there's definitely something about this need to create, and then also the need to get inspiration. And I think that's what's so great about these conversations is, you know, we've done like hundreds of interviews now, and they're all like an hour and a half long. And at the beginning of every one, you know, sometimes you're like, we're doing another one? And then by the end of it, you feel so high and elated and thrilled. And both of us phone each other going like, Russ, I can't believe we spoke to that person. Like recently we met Sharon Stone. And Sharon, you know, obviously Basic Instinct, all these amazing movies and her incredible career. But she was so political, so inspired, and so kind of alive and vital that I left
that
buzzing.
And she makes art.
And she makes art, yeah.
And so going back to the question you're asking about how they come on, why people want to come on, it's because we kind of give them a platform. Like you're saying, you're discovering about Elton John and Pierce Brosnan. We're giving them a platform to talk about something that they absolutely love and are passionate about, but they haven't really had the outlet anywhere to really talk about it because they talk about, you know, parenthesis, their day job, where they're acting in or they're a singer, and that's what people want to connect to. But we're trying to get under the skin of what makes them tick, and for so many of these people, it is art.
And you deliberately didn't want, you know, you were told, don't know more than 30 minutes, people have an attention span. But, you know, you can't just confine these creative people to 30 minutes. Come on, that's ridiculous. How insulting to say to, like, Elton John, only half hour. You want nothing more to say after 30 minutes. You know, ridiculous. But, I mean, that's the joy of it, isn't it? You let people talk. And it's not just about the art, is it? You go to their home. And what Tracy Emin has done to Margate, I mean, it's always been on the map, but I mean, I've gone to the Turner Museum, isn't it? You know, that you go. I mean, she's almost, that creativity has sort of spilled out into the streets of Margate. Margate is a place to go if you want to see good art.
Absolutely. Well, that's why me and Rob are down there all the time. We've both got places down there. Rob lives down there permanently. And absolutely, like Tracy returning to Margate has given the town magic. You know, it's really incredibly special. And that's, you know, she has this phrase where wherever art goes, what's the term? What's she
it's,
say?
It's like wherever art goes, industry follows.
That's right.
And she really believes that art leads the way for all other creativity. So that if you think of it like some kind of weird pyramid, but not that anything's better than another thing, but I think there is something kind of spiritual in a way about art. It's kind of so much about the soul and new ideas and things that have never happened before. And she believes that if art can thrive and be supportive, particularly by governments, by even local like councils or communities. If you allow art to thrive and grow, for example, in Margate, they've recently, there's an organization called Rise Up Cleanup who clean up all the waste on beaches. And it's just all volunteers. They go around every day and pick up anything they see anywhere and clean up the town. And they did this big campaign, like doing murals all on disused buildings around Margate. And now when you drive around Margate, whether you like or don't like the artwork's kind of irrelevant. It's more like there's art all around you and it kind of picks up your day. And it's those little examples that I think it opens up for other industries like fashion, design, just all different worlds that are creative to get inspired. And it kind of clears the space. Art kind of somehow can make space for other creativity, which is a kind of a cool thing.
Now, something I read in the interview that really fascinated me, and I've got to ask you, have you two ever had Stendhal syndrome?
Where you collapse in front of a painting?
Yes, Stephen.
I forgot about that one. I was like, what is that? Stendhal syndrome. Yeah. And I mean, that's very Stephen.
I know. I mean, I've interviewed Stephen Fry on Chatty Man, and he is so clever. Did you feel a bit intimidated? It's a bit like my mum when she used to go to parents' evening and start speaking to, like, you know, the English teacher. My mum would go, suddenly, you know, couldn't even speak English anymore.
I always feel really comforted by him. Like it's his conversations are like a giant hug. And we actually spoke to him during the pandemic. And it was this really long, free-flowing sort of intellectual stream of consciousness. And it was beautiful. And I remember describing him in the intro, like a lighthouse, and that to me somehow he'd kind of, like, you know, shone this light like out across the world or something. He's just this kind of, I don't know, I find him incredibly
safety, isn't he, in some ways? Cultural safety. But he said this amazing story that stuck with me, that he was telling a story. He was in Groucho Club with Gilbert and George and Francis Bacon, and they were all drinking. And at one point he turned around and he went, right, I'm going to go home. And Gilbert and George went, oh, don't go home, you fucker, stay out. And he was like, no, I'm going to go. And Francis Bacon turned to him and went, oh, you've got a little man. And he went, what do you mean I've got a little man? He said, you've got a little man that says to you, come on, time to go home, look after yourself. He said, some people haven't got that little man, you look after him. And he said that, and I went, I've got that little man, that little voice in your head that goes, go home, make sure you sleep, make sure you shower, eat properly, have water. Do you know what I mean? And some people don't have that little man. And it really, when he said that story, it really affected me. And
can I borrow
sort of
your little man? Can I borrow your little man?
You've definitely got a little man.
The voice of authority.
Leave my little man out of this. So have you had Stendhal syndrome? Have you passed out? Have you, has there been an artwork that's moved you? I'll say, but I've never passed out during a piece of art. But there is one thing, I mean, any Gustav Klimt, I love his stuff. I mean, I think, you know, that could easily make you pass out, I think.
I think there's moments where my breath's taken away, absolutely. And there's a Picasso painting that's in the MoMA collection called Night Fish and Antibes, and it was painted in 1939, just before the war broke out. And it's the same scale as Guernica, but it's not as well known. And I'd only ever seen it in books, and it's the way that it's been in books is there's a lot smaller and you can't get it. And when I saw it in the flesh, it took my breath away. And it was awe-inspiring. And it was one of these paintings that I was just so taken aback that it existed and it was there in front of me, and I felt like an instant rush of privilege that I was able to stand in front of this image, and there it was, and I could go really close and look at the paintbrush in, and it's there for us. And so there's these artworks happen, you know, like to that level rarely, but they do happen. We've had lots of guests on that, you know, Rothko is the one that people say they have the Rothko effect.
Oh, yeah,
Pedro Pascal said that, you know, sit in front of a Rothko. And we're sort of programmed to know that a Rothko is going to move you. So I guess whenever I see a Rothko, I sit there and I purposefully go, like, come on, Em, what is it? Am I going to feel anything?
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're programmed.
Because Stephen Fry, in the interview as well, says that, you know, some paintings are like rock stars. And I mean, and listen, that's true. I mean, when you go to the Louvre, it does break my heart when you just see a sea of selfie sticks taking pictures of the Mona Lisa and all that. And yes,
well, you can't even get to it. It's normally just like a scrum. It's yes, like a scrum of people.
And it's so depressing because there's, I think there's like the gorgeous Caravaggio's just down the thing that no one's even looking at and stuff. And I mean, it is depressing. I mean, where do you stand on these rock stars? Obviously, they've earned their place, these paintings. But, you know, you do wish that people are just believing what they're told. And that's not really creativity, is it, when it comes to art? You've got to make your own mind up, surely.
I think it's about an access. And I think we're told about these certain paintings, Da Vinci's, you know, Mona Lisa, Michelangelo, Sistine Chapel, these iconic art historical things that exist. And if that's an access point, that's amazing. And I think that's what, you know, with the podcast where we were listing really big superstar names then, but the fact is that we have no hierarchy on Talk Art. We have these big superstar names. It brings in people who might not have known anything about art or care about art, but suddenly they want to listen to this interview with this person they love who's famous talking about art, and then they might stick around. And then the next week is a super emerging artist who's just started their career, who's just graduated, who might still be in education. And they might stick around for that and be like, oh, that's interesting. And suddenly they don't realize, but it's a kind of Trojan horse, this podcast getting into their ears, because they're being shown that, like, so many opportunities to discover art on every level. And that the fact that this is a conduit, well, at Talk Art, we see ourselves as this conduit to discovery. It is, again, I keep using the word privilege, but it really, really is.
And also in the UK, so many museums are free to get into. And I think a lot of people don't even know that, or they feel this kind of fear of crossing the threshold. But once you do, if you do get in there because you want to go and see, I don't know, like a Yayo Kusama, you know, infinity room, one of those amazing rooms that you walk into, and it's a kind of theatrical experience almost. I think those things are great. But the thing you have to remember is look around. Like, you know, don't just see that one thing. Go into that museum, spend, I don't know, half an hour and see if you find anything else you like. Because the great thing about looking is that you'll discover something that you never knew and that actually reveals something about yourself. I remember for me going to the Tate Modern in about 2001 when they had a huge retrospective of Frida Kahlo, and I was looking at all these paintings and I was so moved by each and every one of them. It was a bit like my Rothko moment, but with Frida, you know, there in front of these paintings with this person that I felt so connected to. And then I went around again and again and again, and the security were like, who are you? You're going to steal a painting? It was like really silly. I spent hours going round and round it. And my favorite painting in there is the one that Madonna owns, who incidentally is now listening to the podcast and followed us recently. Oh. The one and only Queen of Pop. We love her. But she owns two or three.
It's Birth, isn't it? Birth isn't the one with it's on the bed, isn't it? With the legs open. And
that's right.
Yes, I heard that.
My
wow.
Birth. Yeah. And that one literally took my breath away because it's so much about the cycle of life, about trauma, sadness. The mother has died and has like a sheet over her head, I think. And then it's Frida as an adult almost being born. And you see this kind of baby being born. And it's just, it's such an amazing painting. And it's so much about the whole life experience, but also about being a woman, I think. And I just feel like she was so far ahead of the game and real pioneer for like women's rights and for kind of, you know, telling the stories of very personal things at a time when you couldn't really. And also politics as well, which is something as well, I think, as a subcurrent within Talk Art is really important to us. This idea of kind of social change, pushing things on in a way that's really sort of meaningful and lasting.
And speaking of Frida Kahlo, when I was in Mexico, I went to see the murals of Diego Rivera. I mean, I mean, politics, but also breathtaking, yeah. Huge. And I mean, I love the way he just props Frida in there, then Lenin, and like just la la la. But I mean they are really, really powerful. I mean, and I'm like the least political person going, but even I felt like moved. Even I felt like buying a socialist worker or something, do you know what I mean? And going on a strike. Because it was just something about but there's just something powerful about it. I mean, you're also saying about going into museums and art galleries and everything. There was an artist, and this is the joy of your book, you do discover new ones. And I didn't realise, but you got Shaila Kumari Singh Burman, who I didn't realise was the one that did the outside Tate Britain.
Facade.
Yes. Yes, and you talk about, you know, anyone can go into a museum, but this was outside. You can enjoy it even if you can't be asked to go in a museum. And that's the great thing. No, you know, that's the great thing about London. You can find art everywhere. I mean, that, you know,
public art.
Yeah, public art.
That was up during the lockdown. It was like being at a festival when you went down there, socially distanced, of course, but everybody was so starved of culture that people were heading down there, driving past, just to be outside the Tate Britain, to be outside this artwork and to be able to interact with it and connect to other people through art. It was really an incredible moment in history, an incredible moment in her career. She says that was definitely a turning point for the way that people saw her work and her art.
Yeah, and I've always seen her as an incredibly political artist, but also a collage artist in many ways. And you might not realise that straight away, but like when you actually start to even look at that light installation, it's made up of all these tiles, all these kind of like different lights that are almost like stickers or something. And they kind of get, you know, to create a bigger image. And it's very much coming from that kind of collage history. It's really cool.
And she talks about being very proudly working class, which is something that, you know, I kind of connected to definitely, and she's an artist that the way that art can sort of jump class, you know, the way that an artist can be working class, but yet they can then be in the Tate Britain, which is seen as like very lofty and very academic and very, you know, and that's what, again, talk art's tried to break down, is this academic approach to art and this elitist approach to art. And suddenly she's there going, I'm working class, and there I am, and I've made this artwork outside the Tate Britain, like at the National Collection, and there I am. And that is really just incredible.
What do you say to people who want to get into art? Maybe they've bought your book or they've listened to a couple of episodes and they want to get into art. What would you say? Just see as much as you can, go to the Tate, what? Go
well,
to
I local? Think the thing is that I think people are so intimidated, as myself and Rob was when we went to the art world, of going into galleries, going into commercial galleries especially. Because you walk in and they're very kind of quite somber, and there might be a security guard there and then the vigilator sat there and someone at the front desk, and you suddenly feel like you're not welcome. I remember going in and apologizing, going, sorry, and I sort of go around and then sort of be as quick as possible and leave and just feel like, sorry, I took up the space. But the reality is that I feel sorry for my younger self for doing that, because now I would not do that at all, because I realize that the art that's in there, the artists that are making the art want me to be there. And whatever this fortress is that's being built around the actual artwork, the artist wants to connect to as many people as possible. That's why they're making their art. They want people to know their story. So no, whatever intimidation you're feeling or however you feel like it isn't for you, the person who's on the walls or on the floor in there or is in films in there or the sound or anything wants you there.
Yeah. And also art is about life. And like I stopped learning art, like actual making art, like drawing or painting at the age of 11. And yet I now run an art gallery. Do you know what I mean? I didn't really have much formal art history at all or any art education. It was just reading a few books here and there, particularly the ones about Frida. But it was that passion I had for those stories in a way. And I think that's what people need to remember is I often get people coming up to me and they hear I run a gallery and they're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I don't know anything about art because I never learned anything. But what I think the point is that if you've lived a life, we all have different experiences, we all have traumas, we all have joys, we all have loves, and we've all lost love as well. And I think that is what art is. It's telling stories of our existence, of humanity. And that's what's so amazing and revelatory about going into one of these free museums and even to a commercial gallery, where a lot of the shows are brand new works that have just been created or commissioned, but it's free to get in. You don't have to pay anything. So you need to do is, you could probably walk there even.
How many times have we also had guests on that have said, I know nothing about art, I can't come and talk art, and they feel intimidated, and suddenly it becomes this incredibly like complex and like profound and wonderful engaging conversation about art, about how art affects them. And they didn't even realize, I don't think people realize what, you know, we're surrounded by public art all the time because it's there to make our lives better, and it's peripheral for so long.
People look at art like a pub quiz, like there's wrong and right answers, but you know what I mean, there's not really, you know, enjoy it if it doesn't move you. If you go and see the Mona Lisa and like you're not crying, that's nothing wrong with that. That's just not your thing. You might see a Jackson Pollock and then burst into tears at that. And you don't even need to burst into tears. You can just go, oh, that's given me. Because I was talking then about that, you know, what would we say, that syndrome where you collapse. I mean, I've always seen Jackson Pollock in books, and it's never really moved me. But I went to an exhibition of his, and those huge ones, they are proper boom, aren't they? I get it.
Yeah.
I really do get it. when you see
they're like
that.
Constellations, aren't they? Yeah, yeah. Infinite.
Yeah,
and also energy. I think it's so much about life force and kind of highs and lows of what it is to be a human in a way. And if you like Russell mentioned, if you think of one of the first ever interviews we ever did, I mentioned him earlier, but Pedro Pascal, who's obviously now known for Last of Us and has become this kind of global superstar, our friend
like
Ped,
you, Alan,
as I call him. Yes. Like you, Alan. You're our other global superstar friend. But Pedro...
People listening to this will think that I've told you to say this shit.
You have.
You liar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a 4-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
Get over yourself. No, carry on. Sorry.
So Pedro was one of those people who was like, I don't know anything about art. And then the minute he started talking to us, he had so many stories and really like personal moments of kind of like after September the 11th, for example, he went to the museum, I think it was MoMA in New York, and he cried in front of a Rothko. And then he was obsessed with like a Goya painting of a dog. And there were just all these kind of stories within his life that came to life through these artworks. And it's really interesting how he could pinpoint these very significant memories like grief or love or different things, you know, through art. And also people like Pierce Brosnan, who we interviewed, like he has had incredible amounts of grief and loss within his personal life. Like he lost his wife and then his daughter to the same cancer. And painting for him became this kind of therapeutic thing. It was a way for him to escape from his everyday job of acting, but also escape from all of the feelings he was feeling. And I think he brings so much joy to other people through that.
My dad actually texted me today about that Pierce Brosnan interview, because my parents listen to every single episode, well, my mum especially, and she gives a review. And if it's a good review from my mum, I think that's a good episode, because that's really connecting. And he texted me today and he said, just read the Pierce Brosnan interview. How lovely was that? I preferred reading it to hearing it on the podcast. You take more in. Think this book will be a big success. Well done, Kiss.
Aww.
And I was like, that for me was just so moving. That yeah. For my dad to connect like that to this, well, to James Bond, you know, yeah. But the actual art and how you see this different side of people because of art.
Because he says in the interview, doesn't he? He says, I want colour. I needed colour. He had the bad news and he went straight to his canvas. I mean, isn't it amazing that he, you know, you can conjure up yourself. I mean, I wouldn't know what to do if I wanted that. But, you know, to be that talented, to be able to paint and go, right, I need colour. I want colour. Give me colour. Isn't it funny how he used that as a way to lift his mood?
Yeah. He's the reason we have the art heist question at the end, because of, you know, the Thomas Crown affair, which is Pierce Brosnan.
And my favourite movie.
Yeah, and suddenly it was like, we can ask, you know, everybody what their favourite art heist is because of that. And then when we had him on, it was literally like, oh my God, you're the reason we have this question. Here we go.
Well, you know, I heard a story. Now, I don't know if you covered this, but I don't even know if I can even mention it. But did you go to his house and interview him? Was it?
No, we did it. Again, that was a remote one, but he was in one of the Hawaii islands, Kalua. I want to say that. Is it Kauai? Kauai?
No, that's anyway, an alcoholic beverage.
Malibu, was it your tequila? Bailey's.
Oh, the Breeze.
I don't know what it was, but he was Tim Maria. But he was, we managed to speak to him remotely, but he was in his studio. So everywhere he lived, he had a studio. And when he was filming all the movies, he would make sure that he had a studio that was at the side of the movie lot. So between setups, he would go and paint and then go back and film these big action sequences, which is so fascinating.
But my friend worked with him and was at his house. And I don't know if he mentioned this. I mean, I don't know if he wants to mention it. But she said, oh, she said, you've got a Monet here and it's right in the way of the sun, you know, and you've got, that's going to fade. That's it. He went, oh, no, they're all from the Thomas Crown affair, aren't they?
Oh, he yes.
Got, he got to keep
Yeah, I think
them
he
all.
Kept a lot of stuff.
Yes. And
yeah,
she's
all,
like,
the, all the
I don't
forgeries.
Want to tell you what to do, but this £100 million Monet shouldn't really be next to that patio
door. It
shouldn't
be in direct sunlight.
Monet is looking
oh,
down,
that's
really
so good.
Pissed off. So who is on your wish list? Who is on your wish list? So we have, you know, Talk Art, the third volume. Who do you want on there? Obviously, Madonna listens, the queen of pop. We've got to have her on. Who else?
We'd love to have Madonna, yeah. And Russ met her recently in LA, so that looks like it could actually happen in the real world.
Yeah, I met her, yeah. But David Hockney's been their wish list from the beginning because he's like art history. He crosses decades. He knew everyone. He knows everyone. He's someone who's innovative. The iPad paintings, he picked up the iPad and he made that an art form. Incredible. This whole immersive thing that's happening right now in London is just phenomenal. He is, and he's so, you know, working class, you know, and he's so northern, and he's held on to that, and yet he became like a superstar in LA and made hundreds of millions of pounds, but he just held on to this quality, and I think it's so fascinating. That would be the dream, to talk to him. And also Frank Auerbach.
He's still going.
Yeah, he's in his 90s. He's in his studio every day, and he's actually creating. Just done interviews in New York Times, and I think it was the Telegraph, I think, or the Independent. And I just messaged Galleria and I said, please, do you think there's any way that we can sort of turn up at his studio and interview him? That would be amazing.
I love David Hockney as well, because he drew since he was like 3 years old, and apparently he used to draw on the kitchen floor, and his parents would constantly be like, what are you doing? Because he'd just draw on anything he could. I think he like drew on the doors or something in his kitchen. Do you know what I mean? Like just he has this urgent need to make art. And I love that about David Hockney. The other person we really want is Marina Abramovich, the incredible performance artist and photographer and filmmaker and everything else that she's done. And we're in talks at the moment to interview her later in the year. And I really can't wait for that.
I love that quote from David Hockney when someone said, you know, what was it like growing up gay in Bradford? He said, I didn't grow up in Bradford. I grew up in Bohemia. And
what a legend.
I know. What a great thing, you know, to live in your own world and just like wonderful. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Now, listen, say, I don't even know if you could do this, but say you get a phone call and it was Banksy. A, how would you know it was Banksy? B, would you still go for it?
Not you.
Because you know I'm Banksy. You know I'm Banksy. And Daft Punk and Stig.
I knew it all along.
Stig.
Anyone whose face is obscured, I pretend to be. No, I mean, have you had Banksy approach you?
There was a weird like moment where there was potential, and then we were going to use like a voice decoder thing where he was going to talk to us through the voice decoder, and we were never going to meet him, but yet it was still going to be Banksy, but it didn't really happen. But I think it would be like a groundbreaking interview. God, if you managed
I actually
to get-
did PR around some of his early stuff. So I did a collaboration with Greenpeace back in like 2001 or something, when he did the Jungle Book image. And that was for a show that I was part of. And we never got to meet him. And there was always this woman, I've totally forgotten her name. She was really nice though. And she was almost like his manager. And people realized that she was his manager at one point, and then started following her home and following her everywhere to see if they could get to Banksy, but they never found him through her. So it's like really intense, I think, being involved in that universe. And I remember when he did The Girl with the Red Balloon for the first time, and I think it was on the South Bank, and we did this show in the Oxo Tower, and it was around a similar time, and we worked on this book as well that he did, what's it called? Banging Your Head Against a Brick Wall or something. So it's like really early days, but he always had this need to sort of share and create. And I think he's amazing. And I love how he aligns himself with political causes. Like recently he did one here in Margate, and it was highlighting on Valentine's Day domestic abuse and the local charity here called Oasis. And I just think it's a brilliant thing if art can be aligned in a way to a social cause.
Isn't it amazing though as well, Banksy, the fact that in this day and age, with so much social media and security cameras and everything, that this guy who makes his artworks can evade anybody knowing who he is. What isn't that the most like filmic amazing anomaly in modern culture, that actually exists?
Well, I do a lot of my work. Oh, sorry, he does a lot of his work.
You know what, Alan? Yeah. I've just realised it is you, because in the Christie's auction that time, or Sotheby's, whatever it was, where he had that girl with the red balloon, and then it got shredded. Yeah. And so there's a huge wit behind what he does. I think it's Alan Carr. I think he's just unveiled who Banksy is.
Yeah, and the shredder was in the same shape as my teeth. So there was a little clue.
Oh, my God, you gave it away.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Was you inside it? Were you inside the shredder?
Yeah, chewing it with my teeth.
Chatting. Chatting.
So tell us about Jerry Saltz in the book.
I love Jerry Saltz. He is a renowned art critic, and it's nice to have him in the book because it's kind of a different side of the art world, like not necessarily an artist, but someone who's just as obsessed with art as we are. And I adore him because he started his career as a kind of van or truck driver, and he would like do these long distance journeys across America, often transporting artworks. And he got into learning about art history and art through his truck driving, no joke. I think he used to like read in the, you know, truck stations or whatever when you're
not while he was driving.
And then he would learn about the artists, and he got to know all the gallerists and all the curators and all the different people. And it kind of became this huge like map in America from all his journeys. I just think it's extraordinary. And it shows you that you really can, you know, evolve and change the older you get. Like, he's become a superstar late
foremost
in life.
Foremost art critic. Yeah. One of the foremost art critics
in
the world.
And he's globally, his books are like, you know, selling all over the world. And I just think he brings a lot of joy to people, and he has a real sense of humor as well. So I was really proud to have him in the book.
And also, art can be addictive. Art can be addictive as well. And there's that famous thing as well, you know, if you do collect art, you've got two art collections. You've got the one on your wall, and then you've also got the one in your head, the art you didn't get, that you, and it can become an obsession, can't it?
Yes, Russell, it can, can't it?
It is. Shoulda, woulda,
Russell can't sleep
shoulda,
at night.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda. Yes, absolutely. But you sound like you know a lot about art, Alan. You are an art lover, aren't you?
Yeah, I love art. I love art. I do. I always go to a museum. I went to Florence the other week just to go to the Uffizi. I never get it right. Uffizi.
Really?
Yeah, amazing.
So fancy.
Yeah, and I went with a friend who didn't like art, and I don't really know... I'm going to burst into flames saying this on Talk Art, but I got a lady to show us all the way around, and my friend wasn't interested. And we got to the end, and the woman said, "So that is the end. Do you have any questions?" She said, "Do you know where the nearest vape shop is?" I was... Honestly, I was like...
That is art, Alan.
Yeah,
that's
I was like,
art.
Please, oh not God. Now, not now. But I know, I was so embarrassed. So embarrassed.
The title of that work is Untitled, brackets, vape, brackets, 2023.
I know, but listen, I mean, you don't even have to go into an art gallery to see art there. And I mean, I love it. Is it Cellini, the Perseus one opposite David, holding up the Gorgon's head in the square? I mean, you just walk around with your eyes on there. But I do love art. And like I said, you know, when I went to Mexico, I definitely checked out, you know, Diego Rivera. And I want to go to, during COVID, I listened to those Frick talks. You know, the Frick, they picked a certain... That was, I mean, I didn't even know anything about the Frick. So I'm definitely going to go there to New York and see that. I mean, I often check into a gallery. I love it. I am obsessed with the Bloomsbury set. I love all that, you know, Duncan Grant, Vanessa Bell and that. And I mean, it's one of the, they're one of those things, really, you know, with the backstory, how they all knew and got, you know, got on with each other and got off with each other. So, I mean, I love anything like that. And I went down to Charleston, which is it's near Firle, F-I-R-L-E, Firle. And it is just, you imagine Virginia Woolf is going to come through that door any minute. I mean, it is just like it was when she was there, the bed where she died, Vanessa Bell slept and was just ill. Oh my God, it was just amazing, amazing. I love them. I love anything like that. That would be amazing to have one of their paintings.
Let's ask you some of the Talk Art questions then for the end, surely.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
if you
on.
Could do an art heist. If you could do an art heist and you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, you could steal it nicely, what would it be and why?
Okay, what would it be? Gustav Klimt, I love that. I do have a bit morbid taste. I like that one where... Oh my God, I'll talk about this one in the Uffizi. Oh my God, they're back to back. The man's got a hooked nose, all in red. And he's one of the Medicis. And he lost an eye in a jousting contest. And because he was a fighter, he sawed the top of his nose off so he could look with his right eye to see whether... So it's quite a famous one. And he's looking across his wife, and his wife's very pale, which I know is what you do, how you painted them back then in the Renaissance. But then if you look, there is a line under her cheek where she's dead, and he wanted her as if she was alive. And it's so, and he's basically, it's the weirdest painting ever, and it's a classic, and it's in 1400s, one of the Medicis, and he's looking, he's got the weirdest nose ever, but he's had that nose bit cut off. Fascinating. But then I also like that Klimt one where the woman's dead and he painted her as if she's alive. I love anything morbid.
But you'd want to live with those in your house.
All right, now you've made me look like a weirdo. I'd put them in the window. You know when some people put like a picture of an Alsatian in the window? They're quite scary. I live here and I've got a bit of a nose.
In direct sunlight.
Yeah.
Is his name Federico de Monte?
Yes. That's it.
Federico da Montefeltro.
That's it. He's not Medici, no. But I mean,
he's a Montefeltro. But he was a great Renaissance condottiero, which is a warlord.
I get the impression you're reading this from Wikipedia. I'm just having a guess.
I'm not actually. I'm on the Uffizi official website. I'm very chic.
I had no idea that you liked like Renaissance painting and the Bloomsbury set. This is so fascinating, Ellen, like a side of you. This is why you need to come on Talk Art and do your own specific episode, because this is like...
Klimt is very romantic in some way as well. Where have you seen Klimt? Did you see it in Vienna?
Yeah. I went there ages ago, and then I was a bit Egon Schiele. I mean, that's funny about Vienna, isn't it? Like Egon Schiele and all of that, and...
Yeah.
I mean, I just pick things up, and like there's amazing Frida Kahlo documentary that I, visit the Blue House, you know, in Mexico and everything. So yeah, I always go. Do you know how like that for me, seeing art, I totally get it. And that's why I love the book, because the pictures are so gorgeous in your book. You know, it's closest you're going to come to seeing them. I mean, there's just a. It just make me feel nice and make me think and. Like, as you said, what I've described, I like when there's clues in there. I like there's always a clue, you know, or something. I like a little bit of mystery. Why have they done that?
A story within the painting.
Yeah.
So more figurative than abstract, then. You wouldn't really be going for, like, simple minimalism or geometric abstraction if you're more attached to, like, the Renaissance storytelling.
Yeah. Or also, like, you know about, like, you know, Edvard, is it Monk or Munch? I never know how to say it. He loves...
Yes, Monster Munch. His nickname
Munch.
Is Monster. Even Lady Gaga wrote a song about him.
He actually liked the fact that his paintings had a life. And, you know, one of them was stolen and got a dent in it. I love that he actually liked it when his painting lived a life and got, you know, wasn't wrapped in bubble wrap and I'm not sure wasn't invented when he was around, but, you know, that kind of thing. I like the madcap things.
I like the fact that these kind of personal moments and these dramatic stories from history get kind of encapsulated in these objects. Like the one you were talking about from the Uffizi, there's a note here where it says this is maybe the first ever nose job that we know about in mankind.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like these kind of like historic moments. And in our book, when we interviewed Wolfgang Tillmans, that was also during the pandemic, and it became very like personal, the conversation. And there's this amazing photograph of all of his HIV medication where he'd stored every single bottle and then kept them all in a box. And then one day took a picture of the box. And I think there's moments like that, which are so much of our time and these kind of documents of humanity and very personal stories in a different way to those times, you know, 1400s. But I feel like the moments now are just as vital and important
but
and
all
need
art,
to be documented.
All art was contemporary. You know, when that was made, it was contemporary art
at the time.
Yeah.
But they are these time capsules. Good art, like you're talking about Wolfgang Tillmans, that was called the 17 Years Supply, these paintings from the Renaissance, they are time capsules. When art is made, it secures, it keeps that alive, that one moment in history that it existed in, that it took to make that painting.
I love the fact he's lost an eye and he's gone, do you know what? Take the top of my nose. Because I wonder
about
being his life.
He's practical.
He's on
a mission.
Yeah.
Work must be done.
I would be like, whoa. I've lost an eye. No more fighting for me. But no, let's keep on going. It's only a flesh wound.
What's your favourite colour?
Favourite colour?
It's a hard question, isn't it?
It is. Have you read that book? Was by Julian Barnes, The Man in the Red Coat. I love that read, that Stanley Spencer one. And I'm talking about, you know, when there's clues in a painting, he's got this really large tassel right near his groin. And he was a gynecologist. And I think he used to muck around with some of his his paintings. But you see what I mean? I like that where you look at it and then you go, oh, they're always planting little seeds and little...
Easter eggs, they call them, didn't they? Little like,
like in computer games.
Yeah, do you like that? You've seen it though, like the way that the tassel is just hanging there. And of course, he's right. Who's the man who wrote it?
It's a Singer Sargent painting.
Singer Sargent, John Singer Sargent, who also did Madame X, you know, he put the strap back up on her arm because it was too much. Anywhere there's little clues like that that makes you double take.
I love that. What when you do interviews, like we interview people all the time, what do you feel like, just from someone who does interviews and you're interviewing us and everything, do you feel like a responsibility to your guests, or what is it you go in with? Because we always, whenever we interview people, we do research separately, and there's two of us, obviously, so it might be easier, but we do research separately, we never share notes, and then we go into the interview, but we do feel a responsibility to make sure that the guest feels comfortable, because a lot of people are nervous, a lot of people don't know what to expect. But what do you feel like when you interview people? What is your kind of skill set for getting the best out of people?
But you know, it's a bit like your book that, you know, you sent me and I'm interviewing about now. And you know, when I did Chatty Man and when I did it, there is this agenda to try and get the most juiciest, salacious thing out of them. Now, I was always against that. I always like finding out what's their hobbies. It's like Piers Brosnan with his painting, Elton with the photography, you know, looking in people's homes. I always like the other things. I didn't like the salacious stuff. What you do in the bedroom, you do whatever you want. I don't care who you're shagging or what you do. But I feel learning new sides of people, I think is always interesting. And I think some of these TV people, they get it wrong. People want to know, what's your book by the bedroom? What would you steal if you could go into the Louvre? What would you do? That's what interests me. I'm more interested in that, the more human side, than the salacious stuff. So often I would come to loggerheads, I'd have them in my ear saying, ask them if they had that threesome, ask me if they had that threesome. But actually, I want to know what books they read before they go to bed. What's the relationship with the mum? Where do they go on holiday? You know, I feel you get more out of that. And that's what I like. I want to give someone a well-rounded, so people finish that interview and go, I know that person. And I think that's what your book's like. I think when you read it, you go, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. I never knew that about them. That's a good interviewer.
Mm. Thanks, Alan. Yeah, that's lovely.
I've bored you two to death with that answer.
No, you haven't. We've got one more question we always ask is, what is the best advice that you have ever received when it comes to your art?
Oh, I can't think. What? I mean, it's a bit wanky, but like, well, I mean, I talk with my stand-up comedy. It's just do jokes that make you laugh, and you'll get your audience. You know, don't try and be. I mean, I just used to go on stage and talk about things. And now I have people who have the same sense of humour come to see my show. In the early days, it was like, boo, get off, you load of crap. But, you know, I kept on doing it. Your audience will come. Maybe that's it. Your audience will come. And maybe I suppose you can apply that to artists. You know, starting out, people will come, whether it's ceramics or photography. People will come if they like it. Don't change it for anyone.
I guess that works for us, is that if you're true to whatever you do, and we have been true to what we love with Talk Art and the podcast, and we've sort of got this audience now that have come to us because it's genuine and it's authentic, and we've stuck to what we love, and we are geeks and nerds, and we've gone out there and said that, and we've brought people in with us, and that's the most wonderful thing.
And you got 6 million downloads.
Well, yeah, we 6, love that 000, as well. Just Rob,
yeah, not 6,000, 6 million. Yeah, yeah. I also loved it, Russ, when we interviewed like Oliver Hemsley or artists that people don't really know yet, might not even had exhibitions, and who've overcome such kind of amazing personal struggles, but through their art, have kind of, you know, found a way to communicate and to inspire others as well as themselves. And I don't know, I'm so proud of this new book. It's so exciting. Well, we're published authors for a second time, Russ.
It's amazing.
You should be. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And the interviews are great. And also the photography and the, you know, the quality of it is just great. I mean, it's the next best thing to seeing it in a gallery. So you should be so proud.
We're going to put that on the front cover. Thanks, Alan. That's going to quote you for that.
Scroll it over the front cover.
Thank you so, so much. This has been so generous of you coming on today. And it's really wonderful to connect with you through art and hang out with you, and I think it's a wonderful episode. And for everybody listening, all the artworks we talked about will be on our Instagram. Alan, you're on Instagram, right?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I don't put anything on, so don't worry.
Although you have your own podcast now.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah, I do have my travel, but I mean, probably art and travel is my two things I love doing. And if I can combine the two, then that is an absolute, you know, dream. So yeah.
Heaven. And do we have any more interior design masters coming up as well?
Oh, yeah. We're redoing a whole new one for next year. So yeah, it's been recommissioned again, which I'm over the moon about. So yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Congratulations.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, my love.
Oh, brilliant. Our new book, Talk Art the Interviews, is out now from the 11th of May, and you can get signed copies at Waterstones, but you can also buy it at Amazon or anywhere you like, such as bookshop.org, and do support independent bookshops. There's often one in your hometown. I have one in Margate, the Margate Bookshop. So head over to your favourite bookshop and find our new book, Talk Art the Interviews.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye. Thank you, my love. Cheers, love. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.